Just outside the town of Mount Bellew lies a hidden gem. The blacksmith's forge of the old Bellew estate has been restored and hosts a wealth of historical treasures. To find out more about the blacksmiths who operated here, I meet the chairman of Mount Bellew Heritage and Tourism Network, Jimmy Noon.
Well, you're standing in the forge. It's now the Forge Museum. But this was the family forge for Bellew, the landlord. Every landlord had his own forge, so he would have his own independence, he had his own farrier, his own blacksmith. All the implements that you can see around here, most of them were actually handed in by locals. And some of the tools that we have here would be the original tools used by Bannerton, who was the last blacksmith here and was traditionally the blacksmith here. Bellew himself came to Mount Bellew in the late 1700s, and he set up residence here. That road that takes you into the Forge Museum is known as the back avenue to all the locals. That's where the workers came. The landlord never liked to see his workers from his front window. Bellew was able to look across his beautiful lake and his beautiful village of Mount Bellew. And he had his workers on the land. He had over 2,000 acres of land in this area alone, plus lands in Roscommon, down in Mount Albert. Just to show you around here some of the implements or stuff that we have here, we have the schlaan. The schlaan was used by all the people in this area to cut turf, or peat, as they call it. There was two types of schlaans. There was what they call a breast schlaan, which you cut in like that, and a foot schlaan, which you cut down.
Now, Jimmy, I see you have a great array of implements here, blacksmith's tools that would have been used in the likes of this forge when it was in operation. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the pieces that are hanging on the back wall here in the forge?
Well, just to say, all those tools were actually used in this forge, would have been handled by Bannerton, who actually worked in this forge. And there's a certain few bits and pieces. I think the most one I'd show to you is this one here. This was known as a touch. And it's just a simple piece of wood with a rope, a strong rope on the end of it. And that was used to actually put into the mouth of a young horse, particularly a young horse, and to hold her head down or his head down while he was being shod. And they called it a touch. Just a simple thing called a touch. Next to it was a measuring instrument. And that was used to measure what they called the iron tire. To put the iron tire on the cart. They shod the horse and they shod the wheel. It was the same thing. So they cut it round and measured it right round, and then they put it into the fire and heated it and put it onto the wheel. And years and years ago, when you come from the bog on a hot summer's day, if you hadn't got that thrown into a bog hole, you could lose that tire and the whole wheel would collapse because timber retracts with heat, and you had to throw it. They took out the wheel out of the horse cart or the donkey cart and threw it into the bog hole. Then you have the different punches that they used for punching the horse, the horseshoe or punching whatever they be punching. And you have the horseshoes as well. And the horseshoe was made in such a way it went into a fire. Behind you, you had a bellows, and the bellows pumped up the fire, and he put in his horseshoe into the fire, heated it up, took it over to the anvil, and he shaped it. And he shaped it so that it would fit right on the horse's hoof. And they always had a lip on the front of it. And the idea of the lip was to protect the hoof. Because you can imagine the importance of a horse in the family life at the time. If the horse cracked his hoof, he wasn't able to work. More than likely a rot set in. And he wouldn't be able to do the work he should be doing. And in the winter time, he bored another hole right there at the front of it, and he put what they call a frost nail. And the frost nail kept the horse from skidding when they'd be going to shopping or whatever they'd be going with the horse.
The size of the anvil, it's quite a big piece of machinery here. It was integral to the running of this forge.
It was so important. And the thing about the anvil and the works of the forge that time was that the farmer who came in with his horse, every second belt with a hammer was used by the blacksmith and the farmer. But later on in years, and we have it down here at the far end of the forge, they used a petrol organised hammer, a massive big hammer, bigger anvil than that as well. The anvil was the thing that actually the blacksmith needed so much. And he had little holes in it to hang things when he'd have them ready. And it had a point. And the idea of the point was he could go out to the far end of the anvil and start working his way in to make it actually bigger or wider. So that was it. He worked hard. Hard work, you can imagine. Where we are standing here now is a forge museum. We made a museum of it thanks to a group of people, the town development in the 1980s. And thanks to a social employment scheme, Galway County Council and the Heritage Council. We got money. We extended it. We have four uprights, steel uprights, covered with a wooden that was cut in the wood here in Mount Bellew. They are all, there's beech, ash, oak, and they're all trees that identifies that you're living in, that you're actually in the wood. You're in the middle of the wood here now. And that was the idea of doing that. This whole design was done by ordinary lads who sadly were employed at the time in the 1980s and got on a social employment scheme. They used to call it FOST at the time. And it was led by a man called Jim Mangan. Jim Mangan was the actual supervisor. Very interested in his local heritage, local community, and was very... He had a great group of lads with him, but he'd seen everything was just done right. Obviously, we can't see what we're talking about, but in the floor, it was redone as well, re-cobbled. And on the floor, they have a horse and a plough shaped into the floor. Again, done by lads, ordinary lads. So we'll just walk down here. I was telling you about the anvil and the power hammer. Right in front of us here is the anvil, the big anvil, and the power hammer. You can see that, and that was actually worked... Petrol operators walked off a tractor. At the time, they'd have no diesel. They'd be probably a Ferguson 20, maybe a TVO. And of course, next to it, we have the main transport that was used. This was a donkey trap or a pony's trap or a mule. And Mammy and Daddy and the two kids went to shopping, and Mammy and Daddy went to mass. And each in the front of you can see there's two lovely little holders where they had a light with a candle in it. And that was the lighting if they were going to visit their cousins or neighbours at night time.
Can I ask where this was sourced from? Because that's incredible to have that here.
It belongs to Jerry Rush. Jerry Rush sourced it now in Clare. And Jerry is a great support of all that's going on here. Jerry's a member of our heritage group, PRO of our heritage group, and works very hard with us. And we keep it in here. It was painted and kept here. The kids are loved. The kids love to get their photograph taken. I've taken their photographs here. The only thing is that you can't publish it now with data protection, et cetera, you know. But kids love to get up on that trap. I hold it up so someone will take their photograph for their little boys and girls here, so they love it. Behind it is the horse cart. The horse cart came as well, Jerry Rush's uncle that owned that horse cart. He came from Ballygare. He came actually from down in Tully, Ballygare.
Now, not quite as fancy as the wagon we've just seen.
No, now that was the working man's. That was used on the farm. A lot of the implements that you look at here identify the man. Well, in the middle of the horse wheel, that was known as a stock or a man, you know. And just inside the tyres, there was little pieces of timber. Normally, there would be oak. And they were called fellows. And then the iron tyre wouldn't fit it onto. So you'd have to say that maybe it was why they were called fellows, because they were small fellows, if you like. They're all little sections. And they were actually, the iron tyre was fitted onto those.
And again, you have an example of this here. I mean, it's quite a substantial piece as well.
It is. And I have, we have both, should I say, I said, we have both of them because you have it without the actual fellows and you have it with the iron tyre. You have the cart. And you have all the things that would go with the cart. You have the swinglet. The swinglet was used by put on the horses to plough. And those chains put each side, a chain that was hung on to the collar of the horse and onto the swinglet. And they were known as traces.
Now I see here to our left as well, the blacksmith's drill. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
The blacksmith's drill, again, was a modern drill compared to what we're showing you, all the tools and the punches. The blacksmith's drill was a power... worked off a power takeoff as well. All this section of the forge would be 1940s, 45, 50s. While when we were up at the front where the bellows is, they would be all way back 200 years ago or more. They were the only tools they had. Anything you've looking at here is pretty modern. The collar, the horse's collar. When they'd have the extra baby, they used to put the extra baby into the bigger baby the smaller baby into the collar and the bigger baby into the cradle. They used to say it was lucky, but my own impression was the fact is they didn't have two cradles and they had to use the collar.
Make and do
and glad to have it. Mm-hmm. So we'll go up along here because I was showing you the washboard. That's your iron tire now. That would actually be formed in a fire. And it would be twisted right that to fit right onto the wheel.
I think it's wonderful. You have the original fireplace here for where the bellows would have been operating. Like, that's an incredible piece to still have here on display.
We're very lucky to have it. And we're very lucky to have all this because before this job was done with this forge, it had fallen in. And it took a great bit of initiative to do it, and it took a great bit of courage. It's closed, and we're hoping we're going to get it reopened again and do a bit of work on it. It's so important to Montbello as Montbello town. It's so important to the forest walks. It's so important to our latest project, the wall garden, because it all ties in with where we came from and where we're hoping to go.
Can you tell me a little bit about the end of the active forge here when it stopped being a working forge?
It actually was operating just up to 1970. But that time you wouldn't be doing enough, they wouldn't be doing enough showing horses. They'd be making gates, making knives and things like that. But it was there, he was in 1970, the blacksmith was here in 1970. And it closed down then. A lot of things changed here in the early 70s. You had a great fair day here in Montbello. That went. A lot of things, we became a modern Ireland. It's hard to get a blacksmith now. It's practically impossible to get a blacksmith now. We do have a couple of local here, but there was four blacksmiths and four forges in Montbello one time. And there was one in Mylaw. And there was three in Newbridge. Just to take this one little pocket. And if we were to go to Castle Blakeney in Caltra, I know there was definitely two in Caltra. The Maddens were great blacksmiths. In fact, Bellew had land in Caltra, and the Maddens, the blacksmiths, I think that's how they start living in Caltra first, in Bellew's estate. So it would with a lot of blacksmiths. They got a living, maybe not a great living, but they got a living. It was a hard living because there was no windows on them. And you can imagine the smoke, black smoke constantly going out that door there. That door that you're looking at now is a lot bigger than it was then. And you can imagine he probably having a cigarette in his mouth and inhaling the black smoke. They died young men. There were a generation of people that died very young compared with other. Like the farmer was a luckier man, he was out in the fresh air. Or any job you had was easier.
So, Jimmy, we've moved just outside the forge now and we're standing in front of an incredible gate here at the Bellew Estate. Tell me a little bit about where we are.
You're actually on the way into the wall garden now. You're standing at the gate going into the wall garden. Right inside you here would have been the courtyard for Bellew's house. Bellew's house is just over there now to your left. And that would be the courtyard. There was a series of buildings around there. Beautiful buildings them times, and of course they got all knocked down. But the thing about the gates, what we love about the gates, they were made in the forge here, and they were made by Bannerton. And as I was saying early on to you, Bannerton was very proud of his work. And normally if you wanted to find out who made a gate, who the blacksmith was that made a gate, you'd have to turn it up and look at the bottom. But the Bannertons always put their stamp right for everyone to see.
Right there in the middle of the gate.
You can see the base of the gate. You can see the base of the gate, they normally made them. They put them up front. We have three sets of gates here that we had to get repaired. And obviously we had to get them repaired on a forge. And we had to get them back to as what they were. And they are, thanks to a man called Pat Monan, who is actually from Carlestrand. He was the blacksmith that done the three sets of gates. His grandfather would have got a prize here in the show in Montbello in 1929 for the work he'd done as a blacksmith. And the connection is there. The connection of the gates to the forge, to connection of all any work, steel work that was done on the estate for Bellew is evident, and we know where it came from. It's we're dead sure of where we can trace it back. We know they were made in the forge. Not alone do we know they were made in the forge, we have the stamp of the man who made them. And that's so important to our project, the wall garden here. The wall garden is a major project. It's 4.2 acres. We intend to restore it or bring it back as near, rejuvenate is the word we keep using, to bring it back to as good as it was previously. It's the plan to have it as a visitor centre, open the forge as a visitor centre as well. And we see it as being part of what we are about, what Mount Belleau Heritage is about.
What do we know about the end of the Belleau estate here, Jimmy?
Well, in 1939, Belleau's had left here and the house was knocked and it was used to build the roads out in Abbey Knockmoy and out in Briarfield and out that way. They left here. Sir Henry Grattan Belleau and his family are still living, but the house was knocked. We have the Forge Museum, we have the boathouse, we have the wall garden, obviously, and we have the gatehouse as you come in, as I was saying early on to you, the back avenue. We have all that left and we intend to protect that as best we can.
It's an incredible piece of heritage to have here in Mount Belleau, Jimmy, between the Forge and all the efforts that are going into rejuvenating, as you said, this incredible project.
It is, but we're very lucky that in the sense we got 140,000 from Leader to cap the walls, to remove the ivy, to point them. The whole project would have cost 205,000, including our financial input and our voluntary labour. The voluntary labour, all we had 20 and 30 people here in the evenings pulling ivy, not pulling, but removing ivy, because you're not supposed to pull it or you bring the lime with you and you're supposed to protect the wall as best you can. So we had them every day last summer and we had a COVID officer here to make sure that they signed in. Hard to do it. It would have been simpler if things wasn't as they are. But we've got it done. We have finished that phase of the project. Our next phase now is to actually expose 780 metres of pathways. They were gravel pathways where the people walked in and out.
This must be of huge interest to the local school children, both national and secondary age.
Oh yes, regularly we have their tours here and they come down here. The advantage they have to here locally is they can do a walk through the woods and they can be explained to the different fauna and different trees in the woods. Then they come down and they see what we have here, they see the forge. And they can even, if they want a half day, they can go and have a picnic in here. We have a picnic space here, so they can go and have a picnic. So I think they love it. And I think that it's good. In the sense that when I was a young fella, we didn't have anything like that. We went to school, stayed there all day in a classroom and went home. And sure, you'd ask you, did you love school? Well, I hated it. So.
Finally, I suppose, when you see the effort that it takes even to get something as simple as the gates restored, we understand the importance and I suppose the hard work that went in by the blacksmiths that time into what they were doing. They didn't have the modern day accoutrements that we all have now. No.
That's exactly it. You can imagine that every one of those were riveted. He had to heat them and rivet them and dive them in, bore a hole, dive them in, and all the rivets is in it. They were great men, great people that time, because every tool they had was really hard work, and every tool they had could be improved on. But thanks to them that they were doing that. So it's been improved on, all right, but they had to do it without the same power as we have today. You can imagine, even you're looking at a wall that's over 15 feet high, and you can imagine bringing stone up onto that wall, and they had no scaffolding. They had to winch it up with a rope. So you can imagine how hard it was for them, you know.
So let's walk through the gates, because you have something else you want to show me.
Now we're walking through the gates. We're going in what I was saying to you early on. This is actually the courtyard. We're walking on top of a sanded pathway that we made here, thanks to Caoilte. Caoilte actually done this pathways as a gesture when they leased the garden to us. We have a long-term lease of this garden. It'll be here forever and it will belong to the people.
Now, this gives you a view when you're walking down this particular pathway of a huge wall and another one of these fine gates produced.
That's the second set of gates, and there's a third set down at the far end of the garden. On the right-hand side of the gates, we have what they call a famine pot. And we have it turned upside down for the simple reason that we'd be afraid it might get broke. Thanks to the actual agricultural college here, Brother Joe, he gave us the pot. But the thing that I want to tie in with the pot is that there was a monk in the College of Mount Belleau here called Brother Jerome. And Brother Jerome used to feed the hungry. And they used to go into the front garden of what was known then as the monastery, and he used to feed them in that pot. And if they died, he had to bury them, and he made a cart and he carried them down to Ahayat graveyard and he buried them there during the famine. While we have that there, we sourced lumper potatoes 3 years ago, and we intend to sow some in here. We intend to hang that pot next to the where the plot of potatoes are. But up over your head, then up over the gate, is a bell tower. And that bell, we're sourcing that bell. We need to put a bell in there. We need to show the history of the bell, where the bell came from. Obviously, the bell was disappeared. We don't know what happened to it. But the bell wasn't used to call the workers to their dinner. It was used to tell them to go and hide when important people would arrive, to go into that beautiful pleasure garden there. 4.2 acres. Right round that garden you had fruit trees. And the nails were put into the wall to hang the fruit trees. Those nails were made in the forge. And we had a grant from the Heritage Council to count the nails, believe it or not. And we have a report on how many nails would have been used in that wall garden. And to your right in the wall garden, there was what they call a peach house. They had their own peach house. And on the left, you can see a series of chimneys where they had heated walls for a hot house or a glass house, if you want to call. There's actually six chimneys, and we have exposed them all and identified them all. Going right round the wall, from this right round what we know as the north wall.
Just to even visualise it here for people who are listening, I mean, the surrounds, the serenity that must have been in here. And again, from what you're describing, it was a very busy part of the estate at one stage.
It would be. And the advantage, I suppose, for the workers here was that during around the famine, they changed it from a pleasure garden to fruit and veg. He moved with the times, if you like. And of course, they were able to get maybe a few potatoes to take home for their people at home and that sort of thing. Bellew started the market here in Mount Bellew. He started the agricultural show in Mount Bellew. He gave the church to the parish. Mount Bellew was called on Craigon, a rocky place. The square, as we know it now, was a little pond with a rocky mound in it. And Bellew filled it in and he opened a market square. And the idea of this market square first was to actually get his workers and his herds to barter their goods. So if you had wool, you bartered it for corn or you bartered it for potato. Gradually it evolved into a big market, a great market. But again, it's different now. There was often 20 lorries with sook calves there in the square on a Tuesday. But they're gone now. So things has changed, but we are hoping to revive this or bring it back to what we think it should be. Where we're walking out along here, eventually we're hoping to have a farmer's market with produce that will be produced out of the wall garden, sold out here. That would be the plan down the road.
Well, you know, all you're missing now is an active blacksmith's forge.
All we're missing now is a blacksmith's forge. We have a blacksmith on our committee, actually. He's actually of German origin, but he's living down in Stokestown. But he has done something. We done a lovely Christmas show here a few years ago, and he'd done some intimates for local people. But to get a blacksmith now, we'll have an awful problem. But the only thing is that it's going to be a visitor centre, and I mean, we'll be able to tell the story. It's not knocked, it's there.
And indeed, I suppose, because the gates remain now, the story tells itself too.
It does. I mean, you can always say, point out the gates, the name of the blacksmith, so important. And it's all tied in with what this community is about, you know.